The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, recorded on August 17, 2003, in Tewaco, New Jersey.
Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Govani Pacharane Nirvishisha Sanyavadi Paschatade Satarani. I offer my obeisances to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who is very dear to Krishna on this earth, having taken shelter at the lotus feet of the Transcendental Lord. My obeisance is unto you, O spiritual master, servant of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. You're so kindly teaching the message of Lord Chaitanya and delivering these Western worlds which are full of voidism and impersonalism. So, we planned this as a meeting of Satsaput Maharaj and his disciples. And I think it's expanded a little. Jaya Dwaita Maharaj said that he was coming, and our screener Kirtan Rasa told him it was only for disciples, so he couldn't come. But he said that he is a disciple because I gave him sannyas initiation. Of course, he's completely independent god brother first and second initiation, and he's independent in the real sense of the word. I've been staying in New York with Sachi Sutra's family. He said he never saw Jai Dwaita Maharaj before, but he went to a program and he was on a panel of devotees, and he said they were answering questions, and someone asked Jai Dwaita Maharaj something like this: if a husband and wife, Grihasthas and Krishna consciousness, is it possible for them to be in love with each other? And he answered, no. Oh, no, are they in Maya if they are in love with one another? He said, yes. he said, wow, he was really shoot from the hip and precise. So he may answer something a little different than I might. But there was another incident about sannyas guru. One of my god brothers, in the height of the zonal initiation days, was qualified to take sannyas, but he really didn't want to take sannyas from the guru in his zone, although he liked him as a preacher and he worked hard for Prabhupada. He didn't really trust him, so he went to a sadhu in Vrindavan. Back in those days when it wasn't so controversial to do that, and he said, I was thinking, I don't really fully trust this zonal guru, but I figured it's all right because it's just a formality, isn't it, to take a sannyas guru? And the sadhu said, there is no formality in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Everything is done from the heart. So you have to choose guru from the heart. So that person, he decided not to take his own acharya, but he chose me. But it just so happens that we grow up, these sannyasis, and we do express our own ways. Uh, But since Jayadwarta Maharaj challenged me that he's a disciple, he'll have to be submissive at this meeting. And there are some other close friends and faces here who are, they're just friends. I just surrender to their presence. I have an agenda that really wanders over a number of things and important topics. But I think toward the end, I can bring them together. And even though they cover different topics, they're all important. Some of the topics are change, dissatisfaction with your spiritual master, dissatisfaction of the spiritual master with his disciples, innovation, spiritual master preaching in new ways, disciples asking disciples to understand these new ways, understanding the seriousness of the connection. All Krishna conscious topics centered around mostly the spiritual master and the disciple as a serious relationship. So we are changing. About a couple of weeks ago, I did a video for the installation, a commemoration of the installation of Radha Gopi Ballabha, the deities of Boston. I did it in Sachi Sutra's basement with some pictures we had. It was really low budget kind of thing, but he asked me some questions and I answered it. And they played it on a big screen in Boston. And they told me it went over wonderfully. Everybody really liked it. But the temple president told me that a lot of my disciples happened to show up. Some of them I hadn't seen in 6 or 8 or 10 years. So to some of them, one girl in particular, he mentioned, last time I seen her, she was a very, very young, beautiful girl. And he went up to her. He said, "I want to warn you." He said, "Don't be frightened." He said, "But Guru Maharaj has changed a lot since you last seen him. Got a little fat and looks a little sick." And he said, "But that's him. And so you know, don't get too astonished when you see him." So, but I was thinking, if those people who haven't seen me in 10 years, if they looked in the mirror, or if I see them, I get a little shocked at the changes. and can hardly recognize some of you. That's the nature of this material world. But the heart is steady. Our relationships continue. I'm going to read from the Nectar of Devotion about this phenomena of the spiritual master appearing to change in a unpleasing way to the senses, and how we should see this. Being situated in his original Krishna conscious position, text 6, a pure devotee does not identify with the body. Such a devotee should not be seen from a materialistic point of view. Indeed, one should overlook a devotee's having a body born in a low family, a body with a bad complexion, a deformed body, or a diseased or infirm body. According to ordinary vision, such imperfections may seem prominent in the body of a pure devotee. But despite such deeming defects, the body of a pure devotee cannot be polluted. It is exactly like the waters of the Ganges. I was once with Prabhupada and another sannyasi, Devananda, his name was. And Prabhupada had what you would call materially an infection in his eye. And it was all red. And by instinct, he kept rubbing at it. And it would get worse. So Devananda said to him, Prabhupada, don't rub your eye. It's infected and it'll just get worse. And Prabhupada got angry. He said, don't tell me what to do. He said, the pure devotee is never infected. So, you know, medically speaking, there wasn't any wrong with the diagnosis. It was infected, and he could have used better words and said, you know, my dear spiritual master, you know, may I help you and put some water on your eye or get some cream or something for it. Not just say, stop itching, you're infected. But Prabhupada didn't like, or if one were to say to him, you're contaminated, he hated that word. He took those words seriously. Even the word man, once in the early days, 1968, Ray Rama, who was always trying to get on the cutting edge of advertising and things like that, he made a little poster. And it showed Prabhupada and it said, this man has changed the consciousness of the world. And he sent it to Boston. Prabhupada was on the Vyasasana, and I showed it to him. And he looked at it. He said, we should never call the spiritual master a man. He didn't like it. So, it is exactly like the waters of the Ganges, which sometimes during the rainy season are full of bubbles, foam and mud. The Ganges waters do not become polluted. Those who are advanced in spiritual understanding will bathe in the Ganges without understanding the condition of the water. They'll understand that it's still pure, even though it appears full of mud. And I won't read the purport, it's rather long, but at the end he really gets strong and he says, the advanced Vaishnava is always situated as a spiritual master. The neophyte is always considered as his disciple. The spiritual master must not be subjected to the advice of a disciple, nor should a spiritual master be obliged to take instructions from those who are not his disciples. This is the sum and substance of Rupa Goswami's advice. Nobody should tell him what to do if he's really somebody who has spread Krishna consciousness all over the world and has shown so much power in that way. Who is anyone to tell him what to do in Krishna consciousness? So now I'm having a meeting with my disciples. I'm obviously also have so many things that are imperfect, perceivably imperfect, with my body, and with my spiritual life too, and my mind, and they're becoming more and more manifest in recent years. Some of my disciples even have been disappointed at how I've been treating my disease. Taking medicine, and there's always a debate about alternative medicines and allopathic medicines, and so I've been criticized by my own disciples about that, whereas they literally speaking, should not criticize. Now, on this topic of spiritual master being perfect and our viewing Prabhupada as perfect, I wrote a Vyas Pooj a couple of years ago, and I said, I titled it Prabhupada as Human and Transcendental. And I wanted to bring this out. It's always something I always like to bring out, that Prabhupada is not only transcendental, but he's also a human being. Sometimes I get the Prabhupada Lilamrita gets criticized a little bit for making him seem touches of him being a human being and not enough that he was a perfect transcendentalist. Someone I saw in a meeting with Tamal Krishnaraj and his disciples was asked that, and he said, yes, I've heard that, especially in the first canto, the first volume, because it shows Prabhupada outside of ISKCON dealing with businessmen. It may look like an outside man. He said, actually, that's my favorite volume. He said, because now I'm living outside of ISKCON and dealing with academic people, and I see more what it was like for Prabhupada, and that he was perfect even though he was dealing with such people. So a pure devotee can work in the material world and show human characteristics, as Krishna did too. And so I like those things best about Prabhupada, those stories about him. So I quote at the end of this essay from the Chaitanya Charitamrita purport: by the order of the Supreme, the Nitya Siddha remains within this material world like an ordinary man, but his only business is to broadcast the glories of the Lord. All Nitya Siddhas within this material world may appear to toil like ordinary men, but they never forget their position as servants of the Lord. That was Prabhupada's glory, that he could toil like an ordinary man and deliver the highest spiritual essence. I think examples of that are given in the Shakshi Gopal, those two people who swore before the deity that you give me your daughter, and then they appeared to quarrel. He decided not to give the daughter, and then he gave the daughter. They appeared to be acting like ordinary people, but it said they were it was all actually activities of Nitya Siddhas. The man didn't really want the daughter, and the old man the back, but they were acting out some perfect lila. So I ask you not to give up on me if you see some faults in me and some changes in me that you perform, that I perform. Learn how I am and and change with me. So now I want to do something a little innovative. We've been talking about the faults that we see in the guru. They're really there. The whatever it is, bad complexion, or as Ajay Dvaita Maharaj on the morning walk said, sometimes he seems to forget the Sanskrit. Prabhupada said, that is not perfection. Perfection is to be fully absorbed in Krishna. But he seems to have a lot of imperfections. but the disciples should overlook them. So now, one can also play this the other way. The guru can see imperfections aplenty in his disciples, but he should go on loving them and showing his mercy to them despite their imperfections. So I want to play a love song which shows this. It's the lyrics are very ironic, because the lover is criticizing his beloved like anything, and at the same time he says that he loves her just as she is, and he wants her never to leave him. So I see this as an analogy of, can be taken as an analogy of the mercy of Krishna, or even more, the Odarya form of Krishna, Gaur-Nitai. And they must see us as such a bumbling fools in our attempt to be Krishna conscious, but still they accept us. Like funny valentines. Play it.
My funny valentine, sweet comic valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you open it to speak? Are you smart? But don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay, little valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart?
God loves us despite all our imperfections. We should be assured of that. And yet we should try to improve. But His mercy is always flowing. I was saying how I get all kinds of letters. And sometimes letters are critical, sometimes it's appraising. And Here's one that's critical. I'm not going to deal with it at length. But just show you what's going on with me in my life. What's my different disciples, and I'm aware this isn't just one person, but there are others who feel like this, and I struggle with my disciples in trying to be who I am and trying to please them at the same time. I could not find salvation in EJW, which is the primary tome you requested your disciples to turn to, your guileless searching spark which used to illuminate your writings was gone from EJW. Perhaps I'm partly to blame too. I wasn't receiving any volumes from the press, and neither was I pursuing the matter. Also, call me selfish, but I no longer wanted to hear what trials and tribulations you were going through. I wanted to hear how I can bring God into my life in a way to help me. I wasn't finding inspiration in your writings, nothing stirring. How was your painting relevant to my life? Your headaches, I could no longer relate. I have another letter, so I'm going to make my answer brief to this. First, I say that we, as far as EJW is, we print 250 and we sell them all, and supposedly they're read, and the people I hear from, they like, although we do get complaints that they're printed from so far in the past. And I've given an explanation for this. I printed in the last EJW. If I give an argument, it is only from my side, and it still doesn't answer your lack of satisfaction. But I would say that during those down years, I was still struggling, and that the empathetic reader would say, yes, I'm struggling too. That is what it is like in your Krishna consciousness when you're struggling. I never gave up. You said, how is your painting relative to my life? That's a very subjective question. You either like it or you don't. I'll bring that up later. It was very daring of me to introduce this 10 years ago, and it raised many eyebrows, just as when 20 years ago I introduced entering a life of prayer with Christian references. But gradually both the Christian prayer and the painting is sticking on and gaining a Krishna conscious following. They're actually people who have my paintings and have come to Krishna consciousness just from the paintings. It wasn't relative to your life, but it was to theirs. Sorry, my headaches meant nothing in your life, but you doubtless had many pains of your own and can see my pains as a mirror to your own. You could have, in other words. I explained this in one talk to the devotees, that my books are not narcissistic or just about me. They're meant to be like a mirror that you hold up. If I write about pains, then you see your pains or your lack of sadhana or your day or your yearning to be more Prabhupada conscious and more Krishna conscious, failures like that. And then I told her that things are looking up in my writing, that it actually is changing. No new books here? Somebody told me there'd be some new books. Just some samples have come. Where's the big one? Oh yeah. So here's one we've been waiting for a long time. Volume 3 of Prabhupada's Letters to Me. 1970, a memoir. We gave it to volume title. According to him, I am never displeased with any member. And a pretty big book of 400 pages just from 1 year, 1970, and it's all about Prabhupada and the work going on in Boston with ISKCON Press. And but I go deeper than the other two books in exploring the relationship of the guru and the disciples and how they give their life to the guru and try to please him, and how he demands that they do so and work hard and produce the book. And it's the best of the three, and everyone worked day and night to get these books out on real antiquated equipment, that there was no computers, right? These crazy machines that Jayadwaita would know about, how you had to line them up and get certain inches, and then you had to be very dedicated to run those machines and stay up all night. And then I remember Palika staying all night, night shift, and then pouring a hose on her head to stay awake. And then suddenly there'd be a fire. The local thugs would throw a Molotov cocktail against the wall of the outer house, and she'd get a blanket and throw that against the wall, and then go back to work, typing and falling asleep. And that was our offering to Prabhupada. So this is the first copy. And when will the rest of the 1,000 come? And
these are the advance. I'm going to approve them, and then they'll print the rest, and then we'll have them shipped as soon as we can. You said 2 weeks after the approval, we should have
it printed. Okay. And here's a book of poetry. Can a white man be a Haribo? It's a wraparound cover. It's a line I picked up from a street kid in Guyana. He saw me in a car with other Hindu devotees. He was about 10 years old. He was astonished. He looked at me. That's what in Guyana, they don't call devotees Hare Krishnas. They call them Hare Bulls. And he says, "Can a white man be a Hare Bull?" Well, there's poems. And now we're publishing EJW in double, trying to catch up. So each volume is double. Radha Govinda, We Hardly Knew You, and The Lord Reigneth. The Lord Reigneth was painted on the side of a truck in Guyana. And get the title. And this is a special book. The Stoies is a play on the word stories, but I call it Stoies because they're not quite stories. And they're like, they're poems and prose. And in between them, there's these little doodles. So I was advised at the last minute not to print it, but I went ahead and did it anyway. So isn't this good? All these nice books coming out. But anyway, more exciting than that is since I come to New York, and I've just been writing very rapidly and excitedly and with inspiration, just the contrary as that letter that everything is dead, but in a different way. I stopped EJW, so I actually did 70 some volumes in 79, and then decided I'm not going to write this anymore, this daily diary. And I started another book, and it's coming out sort of like an avant-garde fiction, but still I write about a page or so of prose and then a poetry, but then the prose comes, and it's about these 100 or so people who live in a sanatorium. It's called sanatorium, and it's a Hare Krishna sanatorium. And their characters that Dattatreya is the editor. Oh, by the way, I have to give credit to Dattatreya for my funny Valentine. That was his idea. So Dattatreya is editing. He says, who are these people in this book? He said, he thought there must be people that I know. And I said, I don't know any of these people. They're just, I'm just inventing them. They're just coming. He said, well, who's this Jane? Who's this Mr. Barks? And I said, never met any such people, but they're just coming in. So I was really starting to write fiction and all these things that happened to the people in the sanatorium. And so it went on to three volumes of about 400 pages each. And so trying to print it in three paperbacks within a box. And it's a real breakthrough. I heard about a BBT meeting where they're trying to get BBT books onto imprints of other publishers. Maybe even get this on an imprint of New Directions or something. But it's full of Hare Krishna, and I'm not going to compromise that and take it out. Take out a Hare Krishna. So I don't see how I'll ever publish to people who don't like to read the word Hare Krishna. Maybe someday we will spread open. We will be accepted. And I hope I can be in on it. Help crack the wall. One devotee said to me, he says, you know, he said, excuse my street language, he said, but the Buddhists are kicking our ass, he said. He said, in any bookstore you go, he said, you see Buddhist books, Buddhist books. He says, one reason is they're so nice. He said, but still, you know, all they have is the void. He said, we just got to start writing books that will be accepted by more by the public. So maybe if they start reading a book like Sanatorium, they will not reject it on parochial grounds. Okay, let's see. Okay, I have another letter by a disciple. I have two disciples in Russia, and those who have many, they know what it's like. But even to have two, I know that they're very different, mystical, independent, strange, and wonderful, and hardworking. These are two girls, and they have. Printed, translated, managed to produce many of my books, about 12 books, and they sold 1,500 Vandanams and are out of stock, and they keep printing more books and more books. So they're wonderful girls, but they've always got some quarrel with me about something or other. Don't like the spiritual name I gave them, or... But this one girl I get, she's fought with me from the very beginning, because she says that I present myself much too humbly, whereas I actually am a Raganuga devotee. She reads Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Vishwanath Thakurvardi, and so she knows, you know, what the highest rasa is and everything, and she knows that I actually am on that platform, and I'm hiding it, and I'm not telling about it, and so I should do so. So I wrote back to her very sternly, and I said, if you want to be my disciple, you have to accept what I say. You can't say that you know more than I do. Then how can you be a disciple? If I say I'm on this platform, this is the platform I'm on, this is what Prabhupada taught, and this is what I know. So she got very humble and said, I was really puffed up to say that about you. You're right. Humility is the best thing. So it stayed like that for a while. But then she came to translate this book, Begging for the Nectar of the Holy Name. And that one has really stumped her. And she's put it aside. It's very complicated for her because I confess that I'm struggling on the lower limits of Nama Parad and Nama Bas. She said, you wrote this book 11 years ago, and you might not think that you're still there in that stage, but someone has to introduce this book to the Russian devotees and write that things are different now in your life than it was 11 years ago. She said, most ISKCON devotees in those days had no answers to those questions. But now we have the answers. And many ISKCON gurus and senior devotees have at least reached Ruchi, and they give good answers. They also explain how we can gradually connect chanting and meditating on Krishna Leela. We have many good devotees now who explain those questions you asked. I don't criticize your book. I think some devotees could benefit by reading it. Yet I don't think someone has to introduce this book to Russian readers who are living in 1903, not 1992. Now we got Ruchi devotees all over the place. And she's got this book from her spiritual master where he says he's Namabas, and he says, and you don't, you ask questions and you don't answer them properly. You don't give the answers. So how can we give it to newcomers? I hesitate to distribute this book to newcomers. It should be prepared for them to take it. I think a special introduction is needed. So the introduction, I guess, would say that I'm actually at Ruchi, and I wasn't when I wrote this book, or something like that. So I wrote back to her and said that I'm sorry, but I'm still where I was at that when I wrote that book. And I said, and that's, I'm writing, you, I said, you can, anywhere in any bazaar, you can get the Ruchi and Prema, and you can hear about Krishna and Radharani making love in the groves, and what their assistants are doing, or you can find gurus who will teach you that, niche you into that. But Prabhupada didn't teach that, so I have to write what he taught me, and unfortunately I haven't got realization of that. So I can write a little introduction saying that I still don't have the realizations, but this is what this is an odd position of another disciple wanting you to be something that you're not. I like her. We slap back and forth. She also told me that she had a concussion, and she went to the White Mountains where she met a kind of a medical guru who teaches you to say the Jesus prayer by putting your head way down into your heart, and it cured her. So she gave him a picture of me, and he studied the picture and he said, it is too complicated. He will have to come here to the White Mountains. So she said, please, please come. She said, we will get money together and bring you here. And then she said, not only that, but you can see all the Russian devotees, you know, initiate 300 devotees on your way to the White Mountains. And then get more headaches and see the medical guru and say the Jesus prayer and put your head in your heart. So I said, I don't think I will go there. A lot of what I'm trying to talk about is loving, loving our, between the spiritual master and the disciple. So we told about we should love the spiritual master even if he has imperfections, and that Gornitai love us even if we're funny Valentines. Then there's that story that I didn't get initiated on the first time because I didn't love Prabhupada enough. I couldn't surrender. I wanted some freedom. There were some things I didn't like about him. He was a bit of a foreigner to me. I couldn't do it. So I went the next day and I gave him the some typing, because I stayed home all day and did his typing instead. I went to him, he was alone, and he said, "Why didn't you get initiated yesterday?" And I said, "I wasn't ready, but I typed," and I gave him the typing, and he gave me some grapes. And I thought, why only a few grapes? I worked so hard. Then the telephone rang, and he arranged a wedding between Janaka and Mukunda. So then I got up, and he gave me more papers to type. I was walking out the room, and he said, "If you will love me, then I will love you." So it really struck me and changed my consciousness about him, about what love was and what was required. That I was expecting so much attention and love to fall on me for me to love him. But love is work from both sides. And it opened up my heart that I had to love him, and then he would love me. So a few years ago we had one of these meetings, and in a question and answer session someone said, "How do you feel about your disciples?" And I was told later that a number of devotees were all waiting for me to say something, but I didn't say it. They all thought I was, or hoped that I would say, "I love you," but I didn't. It was I said I knew that was a good answer, but it was stuck in my throat, and I said instead, "Well, I accept you as a burden from Srila Prabhupada, and I'm doing it for him. And in some cases it is a burden of love, in some cases it's very difficult." So one of the devotees said later, "That was a really disappointing answer." I said, "Well, it was the truth. It was all I could say. I wish I could have said the other." So since then I've written this poem for today. I call it Love Chant. "Yes, I love you, because you write me letters, because I signed up for this, either out of ego or duty, and to do the duty will cleanse my heart. Yes, because you depend on me. It is a parampara system. I am struggling to deliver the goods. I like to be carried in a palanquin, dragged through the mud on a sled, worried about my butt. Produce something, but I'm getting old." Then here's a quote from some other person. The gist of what he's saying is he's slowing down and hears rumors you'd like to boil him and serve him as a feast. But he says, no, he's really young and hip and presenting Krishna consciousness in as good a way as he ever did for the evolving world, unquote. A lot depends on my new writings and paintings, if you'll accept them. So do you love me? Can we keep on loving as we used to in the old days? Or may I say these days? we're so long together, can we stick together and see I am loving you? It's natural from the beginning. I can teach you the right attitude. I am not burnt out. You need me. I need you. We must stay vital and keep it up in the way, and keep it up in the way we are. Some more innovation coming up. A few days ago, I heard Bibi Govindas Maharaj's 10-person bhajan band. I think some of you probably heard it also as he traveled around. He has his own wonderful kirtan voice, and he has electric bass and a violin player. They're all from that eastern country. They all look very eastern. And violin player, another violin looking player, a bigger violin, and Madranga. And then most outstanding is a girl with silver alto saxophone. And she was very modest, dressed in a sari, always keeping the sari, covering her head. And so they just played a Hare Krishna bhajan, but she was really fantastic. She played so well. But all he let her do was just play a few riffs in the background. But even at that, she played them so well and innovated within that limit. And then, once he let her play for about 15 seconds, and then he let her solo for about 30 seconds, and they were really incredible. That's all he let her play. But then the whole thing was good. Then I didn't get a chance to talk to him later. I was going to say, you're like Marco Polo. You went to the east and you brought back some gems. And I say, he has a car and he calls himself the king of kirtan. So I didn't want to be presumptuous. And I said, but I have one humble suggestion. If you could let that girl blow a little longer. I said, I think your audience would appreciate more than 15 seconds. She's really a good player. You seem to have, got her training in some formal orchestra and Eastern and some American jazz in there too, and is very freely playing. So I was encouraged. That's such an innovative thing. Then he said he played at 26 Second Avenue, and he was on one side of Prabhupada Murti and she was on the other side, and about to play, and he turned to her and he said, "Play for Prabhupada." And so then they played together, and he said people really liked it. And I said, well, I said if it was back in 1966, they really would have liked it too. So that's an introduction to I'm going to play, not myself, I'm going to play a recorded saxophone that I used. Now this is set it at number 2 silently, and then I wrote my Vyas Pooj homage that year to this composition that John Coltrane Quartet played. It's called The Wise One. And as soon as I saw the title right away, I thought, oh, that sounds wonderful to write That sounds like a guru and something to write about Prabhupada. So I did. I wrote a poem that was in my Vyas Pooj. So my poem is not so long, and that's 11 minutes. So I'll read my poem, and when my time runs out, I'll try to keep talking what can come to mind. So you can play number two. And when I don't talk, you can also hear this beautiful quartet. Louder. Wise one, guru. Louder. Wise one, from whom we revolted, refused, found it too hard, either to desert or not to. The war rages on around us. You maintain louder within us that lamp in a windless place, because you gave us your time. As eternal guide, you taught in Parampara. You made it clear. I'm writing this letter to you, aware that separation brings on strange changes, and time does that too, and that we may not quite recognize each other the way we used to, but there's a live connection and it's personal. I sometimes think I'm all alone, holding up my end. I dare not ask if you have forgotten me in your samadhi. Where are you now, Srila Prabhupada? It seems a futile question because I can never feel it quite enough. You asked a better question of your Guru Maharaj. How can I serve you? You were full of dance. You sent us out to preach. You said, if they arrest you and put you in jail, go on chanting Hare Krishna, don't mind. You were pleased and we rallied. We somehow stayed in your group and your temples, although now we have splintered. Our impurity is telling. Wise one, dear servant of the Lord, I write this letter to be with you. It's a lingering, a kind of prayer. We didn't live in confusion. We needn't live in confusion. As long as we can hear the words you spoke, which made even Vyasadeva's message clearer or more appropriate to our struggle to take up Krishna consciousness. John Coltrane never met Prabhupada, although his wife did. It said that he loved his wife very much. She acts as a guru now in San Francisco. He's written a book. I read a book about John Coltrane where a man said that at that time, America, especially New York, East Side, was turning east. Mantras, scriptures, Hare Krishna, said, and Coltrane was the matrix of it all. I was so pleased to see that, because it really wasn't popular among, like, Beatle fans. But he was the matrix of a kind, for many people, of the spirituality. When I heard his song, A Love Supreme, I phoned my sister, because he was already famous. And I said, oh, John Coltrane has made this record, this spiritual record, and on the liner notes, he's written his prayer to God, that God is everything. It's the wind and the... And that he, Coltrane, has had a recent profound religious experience that has changed his life, and he's given up all his bad habits, and we should all pray to God and praise God. I said, it's like the toughest guy on the block has suddenly turned religious. And so, like, you know, everybody's kind of saying, hey, what's this? I have to do this too. My sister said, oh, Stevie, you're always going with some fad or something. But it wasn't a fad. I used to listen again and again, and I would play. I wrote a long poem. I called it God the Axe. And it wasn't long after that that I met Swamiji. But here I see, he sees a guru in a generic way, like the peaceful man who lives on the mountaintop. He may be a Buddhist or a Taoist. Of course, Mao Zedong decimated all the Taoists in the Himalayan mountains. And that kind of life, though, even in India, the Babaji's, they wanted to just live alone and not be bothered. There's a famous poem by Li Po, the Chinese Taoist. He said, you ask me, why do I live alone in the mountains? I smile and do not answer. The peach trees are blooming and the fresh rivers flow. I live in a world beyond your world. But in Krishna consciousness, we know more. We know what that world actually is. Where Krishna is, Radha is, because we have a guru, Srila Prabhupada, who lives beyond all these worlds, as we're learning in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, world beyond world, beyond world, beyond world. So he's the wise one. He knew how to manage, and he brought us to realize that we had to also deal in this world, to print books, to deal with the senses, and to try to convert people to Krishna consciousness, but be peaceful too, like the wise one. Now I have another metaphor. Thank you. This metaphor comes from a book of fiction. A very good writer named John Fante, Italian-American, like Frank Sinatra. It's called Full of Life. He wrote in the 1940s and 50s. And it's all about how his name is Arturo, and his wife's name is Joyce. And he was born a Catholic, but he became an atheist. And his wife is a Protestant, and she's a materialist too. But during her pregnancy, she goes through a lot of changes, as women do. And she becomes a spiritualist, and she becomes specifically a Catholic. So his father, he's a real meddler. He hangs around their house. Now he's fixing their fireplace because they had termites. So he's come there to fix. But he's a real wino. He drinks a lot, and he curses, and he interferes with their affairs. So the son is not very glad that he's there. But he wants a grandson. So he wants to see this happen, that his grandson is born. And so he's on the side of his wife, daughter-in-law, whatever she wants. He's become kind of the enemy of his son. So the son does not want to convert to the church. And instead of his integrity, he just can't do it. He doesn't believe in it anymore, although the wife has had this sincere conversion. So it develops into a real drama. 4 days before the baby was born, Joyce entered the church. This is going to have to do with guru-disciple relationship, so hang on. I'm not converting you to Catholicism. She was christened Joyce Elizabeth. The ceremony took place in the evening after the baptismal font in the church of St. Boniface. Her sponsor in baptism was our neighbor from across the street, Mrs. Sandoval. She was a tall, serene woman in her 60s. Father Gandalvo had selected her because she lived near us and because we knew no Catholics in town. Joyce's happiness was almost terrifying. As Father Gandalvo read the ritual, first in Latin, then in English, tears ran freely down her cheeks and crashed on her bump. Hers was a shattering kind of happiness. She was almost grief-stricken with it. I stood with my father in the background, watching, listening to her sobs as they echoed through the empty church like the flapping of wings. All of us were badly shaking. Papa dabbed his cheeks with a large blue bandana. Mrs. Sandoval smiled bravely, unashamed of her tears. The ceremony was long, for the priest gave her absolute baptism. This cleansed her not only of original sin — the Catholic believes that we're all born with an original sin, and when you're a little baby, you receive baptism, and then that sin is gone — but she was never a Catholic, so she's only getting that freedom now. But she's getting freed of all the sins of her life. She wept steadily until Father Gandalvo became choked up too. His eyes blinded, and he broke off the ceremony to dig a handkerchief from under his cassock and wipe his eyes. "We shouldn't cry," he whispered. "This is a time for happiness." It provoked a fresh outburst from Joyce. "Papa," and I led her to one of the pews, where she knelt heavily, her face a smear of makeup, mascara, and tears. "I'm sorry," she wept. "I'm terribly sorry, but I can't help it. I'm so happy." "Your face is a mess," I said. She stopped crying instantly. Women. She opened her compact and fixed her face. Without a word, she returned to the baptismal font, and the ceremony continued. Quietly, her eyes cast down, her hands folded, she experienced the purification of her soul. Then it was over. It was over for Joyce, but not for me. Afterward, we gathered outside the church. Mrs. Sandoval had a baptismal gift for Joyce, a silver St. Christopher's medal. Joyce was delighted with her godmother. They walked arm in arm to Mr. Sandoval's car. We waved goodbye as the older woman drove away. The moment I had dreaded now arrived. I looked at my wife. There were stars in her hair, stars in her eyes that bathed in tears a moment ago, shone now with high happiness. It seemed absurd that her conversion should make such a great difference, yet it was so. She was not the old Joyce. She was not the Joyce of even an hour ago. There was no solving the chemistry of this change. I only felt it. I knew it. I saw it. The thing I felt was a maturity, a quality of womanhood, not associated with her pregnancy, a tradition, rather, of an identification with Mother Church, with the Church's high reverence for women, an elevation of her to that state I felt for the Virgin Mary as a boy. We looked at one another, and in that moment, she too knew that I had sensed the change, the all-pervading transformation of her personality. We looked at one another, and in that moment, each of us knew that this night was a milestone in our lives, and that our lives together were terribly important, terribly serious. But it was a sad moment, too, because I cherished the nonsense of living, the trivia, the fooling around that we had put behind us. Now, this, I think, is a very important point regarding spiritual master and disciple. Now, this is a potential breaking point for them, that she has entered into the Catholic Church, and he's not about to, and she's changed so much. She's become like a very saintly, and he is not going to become so. And yet they both see how serious their lives are to each other. So, like, if there are things about me that you don't like, that I'm going through, and there are things about you that I don't like, we should see also that our lives together are very, very important, even though we go through different important changes. So I thought that was a very telling paragraph, that they're right at the precipice of breaking, you could say, but they see that despite even this change, from as man and woman, they're seeing this. We mean a lot to each other, and whether it's Catholic or something else, our relationship is very, very dear. The big hand of Father Gandolfo, the heavy arm, came down around my shoulder. "Well, you ready?" He meant, was I ready to go to confession? I wanted to say no, Father. I said, "Yes, Father." "Good. Tomorrow you can receive Holy Communion together. The Mass will be for you. After, I'll marry you at the main altar." "That's fine, Father." He walked back to into the church. The priest genuflected and went down to the side aisle to one of the three confessional booths. Heavy purple curtains draped each entrance. Father Gandolfo disappeared inside the center booth. He turned on a light. Joyce, Papa, and I walked down the center aisle and entered a pew directly across from the confessional. I knelt down to examine my conscience. After 15 years, I was going to confession again. What were the sins I had committed in a decade and one half? The task before me was enormous. It was so vast, I could not take it seriously. Worse, I felt no contrition. I regretted nothing. Good and evil, I had enjoyed it all. The laying on of the priest's hands in absolution seemed meaningless. I would not enter the confessional. In the old days, my very blood sang in the answer to the call of absolution. Gladly, I used to fall on my knees and pour out my troubles and become cleansed and walk away with the mighty muscles of a pure heart. I clutched at the past. I found nothing. Time passed, 15 minutes, a half hour. with the priest waiting patiently. The tussle with my conscience left me exhausted. How could I confess that for which I had no remorse? Wearily I sat down beside Papa and Joyce. "I can't do it," I whispered. Papa looked startled. "Please try." Joyce smiled. "I can't. It's hypocrisy." Papa consulted hurriedly with Joyce. "What's wrong with him?" "He doesn't want to go," Joyce whispered. "He's got to go." His voice was loud. I shook my head. "Can't, Papa. Get in there." "I tell you, I can't." "You've been a bad boy. Get in there. Get in there." He grabbed me by the nape of the neck and tried to push me toward the confessional. I clung to the pew and refused to budge. His face reddened with effort. Suddenly he was on his feet and moving quickly toward the confessional. We watched him in surprise. He turned back at us, his eyes desperate. Then he entered the confessional booth. I later learned that it was his first confessional in 55 years. So he's trying to, like, blackmail him. He never explained why he had done it. But it seems like he's just blackmailing his son so that he'll do it, and then they'll get then he'll get his grandson in a pure state, because this Papa is he's a dyed-in-the-wool drunkard and gambler, and so you really can't trust him. Whereas we know already in this book that Arturo is a man of integrity. He just can't do this, so he's not going to do a cheap confession. I was certain he had not planned to go. He had never dreamed of going, but in his own fashion he had done this thing for me, for his grandchild, because it had to be done. His confession was in the nature of an argument that was given in Italian, a rumbling discussion, indistinct and intense. Whenever Father Gandolfo said anything, Papa answered sharply. The priest in turn raised his voice. They talked with their hands too, for you could see the curtains flapping. Finally, the confessor's voice prevailed. No word came from Papa. The priest spoke very gently, pervasively, and in a soothing whisper. When they emerged, both men were tired and perspiring. Papa dropped on his knees in the nearest pew. Father Gandolfo smiled and patted him on the shoulder. Papa covered his face with two hands, crushing out all distraction as he said his penance. The priest shot me a disheartening glance. I got up and walked outside. He was waiting for me on the steps. "What happened?" "I couldn't make it." "Would you like another confessor? I could call Father Shaw. Would that help?" "I don't think so. I'm bitterly disappointed, you know." Of course, what this means, I knew. It meant I was not in a state of grace. It meant I could not go to communion with Joyce the next morning. It meant I could not receive the sacraments, and marriage was a sacrament. "I'm sorry, Father. I'll keep trying." He turned to Joyce and Papa as they came out of the church. We said goodnight. Papa refused to look at me. We walked to the car. I took Joyce's hand. "You're disgusted with me." "I'm disappointed, of course." "Give me a little time. I'll do it someday." "That's what I can't understand. If you're coming back to the church someday, why not now?" "I don't know." "I don't either." "I'm going to take a little walk," Papa said. We watched him move toward the corner. He had a quick, bouncy step. He paused under the street lamp to light a cigar. The smoke drifted back toward us, fragrant in the night air. He didn't speak as we drove home. I locked the garage and we walked into the house. In silence, we went upstairs. I hesitated before my door, hoping she would speak. She entered her room without turning around. I pulled off my coat and threw myself on the bed. I felt no grief for what I had done, no remorse. It exasperated me that there was not so much as a quiver of regret. It left me lacerated and miserable. Then she came through the door, the white balloon floating under her nightgown, a book in her hand. Smiling, she looked down at me. "I want to read something," she said, and she read. "O Father, O Mother, O Brother, O Friend, I have lived with you after appearances hitherto. henceforward I am the truth's. Be it known unto you that henceforward I obey no law less than the eternal law. I appeal to your customs. I must be myself. I cannot break myself any longer for you or you. If you can love me for what I am, we shall be the happier. If you cannot, I will seek to deserve that you should. I will not hide my tastes or aversions. Emerson, I said. Oh, sweet man. She bent down and kissed me. Good night, she whispered. Blessed be the woman that bears my son. I cried with happiness. So, at first I was wondering a little bit what this all meant. And then I came to the conclusion that and knowing what, and then I read the full essay by Emerson called Self-Reliance. Emerson was a minister in a church, the Universalist University. Then he quit. Then he partly came back. Then he quit because he didn't want to follow the dogmas. He wanted to teach the truth about God according to his understanding. He wanted to be his own man, and so he became very famous for his essays on philosophy and truthfulness and being true to your own conscience. But why did Joyce read this to him? My understanding is that she is accepting her husband. She doesn't believe Emerson is better than the Roman Catholic Church, but she sees like he's an Emerson man, that he can only live by his own integrity. He can't be bullied into the Catholic Church. And that's who he is. And so she's smiling and she kisses him. And so and he says, blessed be the woman that bears my son. So she accepts him. And So for our purposes, sometimes in our relationship, you may not accept something I do, like my painting or some innovation that I do, and I may not accept something that you do. But like earlier we read, they exchanged looks and saw how serious their relationship was to each other. Even if there's some difference, they owe to each other to love each other and to live together. That was my understanding of this book and the relationship of the husband and wife. And why he was so happy that she read it to him. She didn't. She was very disappointed, but she didn't coldly reject him. She says, "You know, this is my husband. He's not going with me in this step that I so much wish he would, to become a Catholic. But he's a man of great integrity, more than Papa. And out of that great integrity, he can't." He can't go to confession. Right now he can't become a Catholic, but he's a man of truth, and that's why he's doing what he's doing. Get it? How are we doing? 12 o'clock, 10. I got more to go. That was a little indirect, I know, but some teachings are indirect. If you think it over, you can get this book. It's called Full of Life by John Fonte, speaking of imprints, it's Echo publisher, an imprint of HarperCollins. He's a really good writer. And I was thinking that Papa, you know, is trying to blackmail his son, but how long is he going to stay in a state of grace? And also, how long is Joyce going to stay in the state of grace? She's a woman, and you know, the real strength in that family is the man. And if she gets weak, he'll be there. And they love each other so much. And he'll never abandon her, and she won't abandon him. So people can have different religions even. But guru and disciple shouldn't break. They should try to find a way not to break, to come closer. I don't know if I remarked it, but when I read that first letter about I don't get anything, nothing stirring, I think I remarked that one answer to that is one can take the Shiksha Guru. And that's very much a tradition that one can do that. Oh, and then there are disciples of mine who have taken Shiksha Guru, and I thought it was fine. But others have done so, and I didn't think it was right. It just seemed like they didn't try enough, and that we both didn't try enough, and it wasn't right. Because the Shiksha Guru is teaching you so many things. The Diksha Guru is still the Shiksha Guru. Prabhupada writes, the one who was originally the Shiksha Guru usually becomes the Diksha Guru. So he's got, there's a devotee in Ireland I'm having a spat with, and I'm the first one who ever, there was a public lecture, he heard Krishna consciousness from me, then he started reading my books and he liked them very much and used to read them a lot, and it brought out a lot of brahminical quality in him to read books, and Prabhupada's books. I emphasized to him he should take care of his family, which he was neglecting to do. A lot of different things that I helped him with. And then he developed more and more a desire to be involved in the managerial aspects of the institution. And I couldn't help him so much in that, because that wasn't my inclination or ability. So it grew in him to the point where he thought that he couldn't get anything from me, and so he was turning more and more to associating with those who could. And so we've been writing letters back, finally writing for a while, we weren't even writing, and I just wrote to him, I said, you haven't finished your shiksha from me. I said, there's so much more that you can learn from me that would help you with management in a personnel way, and would help you with all the other aspects of your Krishna consciousness that you have to go on with. So it's not just that you learn from persons a certain trade, but you have to learn spiritual life always from your spiritual master, who initiated you, and don't cast him off. He thought he had a kind of liberation idea. He thought that I have to follow my spiritual master in all particulars. And then I told him, no, that's not true. You don't have to follow your spiritual master in all particulars. You can get guidance from others in particulars that they can teach you in. And this was like a complete breakthrough, like a liberation when he learned this. He said, oh, I didn't know this. But he went so far with the idea as to say, oh, that my Diksha Guru is not needed. I can get information from others. And he just like went around associating so much with others who he thought were now going to be helpful, and he didn't need a Diksha Guru, but the Diksha Guru continues to be the Shiksha Guru. I got a little more. Got real heavy thing here. So we were talking about how in the Nectar Devotion verse, if the spiritual master appears to be going through difficulty, don't see it that way. But there's this essay I've shown to a few devotees, which is really profound. I gave it out to some too. About when a devotee really is really down in his spiritual life, and we sometimes call passing through the dark night of the soul, and when this happens, you may not be able to. Your sadhana may really go low. Your enthusiasm for Krishna consciousness may be lost, and you may not even talk about it with others, but you don't feel very Krishna conscious at all. Just externally, you may go to the festivals or something like that, but you really feel like you're going nowhere, and Prabhupada feels very distant, and Krishna too, and so forth. So it's hard to confess or even hear about this, but if somebody can confess this on behalf of all fallen souls, it's purifying. And it helps purify you. So I've read this to some others, and I've passed this out about the low state that a devotee may reach, and yet it contains the hope for coming out of it. So this is a paragraph from a poet who writes a lot about spirituality. He has a book called Prayers to God, and his name is Rainer Maria Rilke. So he's writing about trying to raise himself to God. You have to pay attention. It's a deep subject. But since you're all involved in this, if you pay attention, you'll be able to understand. The he is you. For though he had wanted to hold himself back forever, he was now once again overcome by the growing urgency of his heart. At this time, he hoped to be answered. His whole being, which during his long solitude had become prescient and imperturbable, promised him that the one he was now turning to would be capable of loving him with a penetrating, radiant love. But even while he longed to be loved in so masterful a way, his emotion, which had grown accustomed to great distances, realized how extremely remote God was. There were nights when he thought he would be able to fling himself into space toward God, hours full of disclosure, when he felt strong enough to dive back to earth and pull it up with him on the tidal wave of his heart. He was like someone who hears a glorious language and feverishly decides to write poetry in it. Before long, he would, to his dismay, find out how very difficult this language was. At first, he was unwilling to believe that a person might spend a whole life putting together the words of the first short, meaningful exercises. This idea of a language is just a metaphor. Doesn't mean that there's an actual language, but a revelation of practicing God consciousness, loving God. He threw himself into this learning like a runner into a race. But the density, you could say, like of learning to chant Hare Krishna, the density, he threw himself into the learning like a runner into a race, but the density of what had to be mastered slowed him down. It would be hard to imagine anything more humiliating than this apprenticeship. He had found the philosopher's stone, and now he was being forced to ceaselessly transform the quickly produced gold of his happiness into the gross lead of patience. Now that's like when we first come to Krishna consciousness, we get the quickly produced gold. Prabhupada gives you your beads, or someone gives you your beads, and right away you usually feel some happiness of chanting and being a devotee. It comes fast. But that quickly produced gold becomes gross lead of patience later. He who had adapted himself to infinite space had now become like a worm crawling through crooked passageways without exit or direction. Now that he was learning to love, learning so laboriously with so much pain, he could see how careless and trivial all the love had been, which he had thought he had achieved, how nothing could have come of it, because he had not begun to devote to it the work necessary to make it real. During those years, the great transformations were taking place within him. So it's not like nothing was happening, like when you feel, oh, I was becoming Krishna consciousness, but I'm not. No, it has been happening. We have becoming Krishna conscious, but it's a long patience. It's not easy. We have to wait. He could see how careless and trivial all the love had been, which he thought he had achieved. How nothing could have come of it, because he had not begun to devote to it the work necessary to make it real. During those years, the great transformations were taking place within him. He almost forgot God in the difficult work of approaching him. And all that he hoped to attain within him in time was the patience to supporte un am, his patience in enduring a soul. Real patience like lead. So you have to be very patient to proceed in Krishna consciousness. Forgive yourself that you don't chant so well, and that you're not advancing so well. That's what you've got now. You don't have the gold that quickly came, but don't be, like Prabhupada used to say, don't be disappointed, and keep associating with devotees and the spiritual master is part of it. Don't give up on him, and be patient. I'm going to finish on a bright note, because that's the lowest note, isn't it? The poem by the same poet, Dove That Ventured Outside. Dove that ventured outside, flying far from the dovecote, housed and protected again, one with the day, the night, knows what serenity is, for she has felt her wings pass through all distance and fear in the course of her wanderings. The doves that remained at home, never exposed to loss, innocent and secure, cannot know tenderness. Only the one back heart can ever be satisfied, free through all it has given up to rejoice in its mastery. Being arches itself over the vast abyss. Ah, the ball that we dared, that we hurled into infinite space, doesn't it fill our hands different with its return, heavier by the weight of where it has been? So this first passage was saying we're just lead and we're like a worm, and all we can do is be patient. But in a different mode, he's saying we can dare to just get out of this prison-like condition if we just do something we never tried before, experiment, do something from your heart to reach Krishna, and don't just stay in the protection of the cage, and then you can come back, but you will have learned something that those who never ventured never will have learned. So, anyone want to ask any questions? Yes. But if a person does that and then gets a letter back and says you're wrong, you're overestimating my position, they should take that seriously and not again say, no, you're a prema bhakti. So then they're just speculators and knowing more than the spiritual master.
I was wondering how your health would be while you were out there, how many times you involved. Were you born to write a book about your stay there?
I couldn't hear so well. How is my health?
How was your health, and was it better while you were in Sacramento?
Well, I was where? Oh, yeah, I've been getting better since I've been living there.
Were you going to write something about your adventures while you were there?
Well, I said I did. I wrote a book. It's not so much about my adventures there, but I wrote a book, sort of a fiction called Sanatorium. It wasn't about my adventures there, about the people there or anything. But it was an inspiring place to write. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, you've asked us to write regularly at different times, and I've struggled with that. Sometimes I would write every codicy, and then I would write every month, and now I'm writing every year. So I don't know how often you want us to write.
And I've also been saying, don't write, write, don't write. So right now I don't even have an address. we're trying to make a system of how to write. I'm moving to California for a while, and I'm trying to set up a system of how to receive mail and answer mail. Which I don't have, but I'll let you know about that. But once a month is good, yeah. Yes.
You might also mention when you're talking about the correspondence that one of the new features of Among Friends is that you're accepting questions and want to write, want to respond to those questions and they'll be
published. Yeah, we've revised Among Friends in a number of ways. The first section of Among Friends, since I'm not giving so many lectures, will be questions and answers. And so I need questions, and then I'll answer them, and we'll have several pages of questions and answers. So the editor is Nandi Mukhi, and you could send questions to her, and then she'll send them to me, and then I'll answer them. So I think we're kind of struggling to get enough for each issue. So, you know, philosophical, personal kind of question. And also, in Among Friends, we have a section where we're asking for devotees to write something of their own about Krishna consciousness, their own. Not about me, but just some reflections on Krishna consciousness. So that would be nice if you could do that. Yes? There's a whole history to it. And how many years? 15? Seven?
17.
Rabindra Sarup has written a history of the change of ISKCON, I think covering that period in a ISKCON communication book. I'd rather not try to cover that.
I understand there's a lot of differences
in
devotee lifestyles and political things, which really aren't the most important thing, but I'm wondering just your perspective on how you feel about the movement here now. I guess, I mean,
Well, one thing is my disciples are living outside of the temples as married couples. That's just a phenomenon. And there was a scholar, such as Rochford, took a survey. It's getting a little old now. I think it was 1999 or something, of a large number of devotees who lived in the temple, outside the temple, and so forth. And I think he found that most devotees lived outside the temple, and that their sadhana was just as good as devotees living inside the temple. But certainly there are strong temple populations around the world too. I'm really not so much able to tell you myself how much ISKCON has changed. But if you've been away, you should come back and find, if you don't find that you like to live in the temple and live outside the temple, but you should associate with devotees in one way or another. There are nice farm communities, city temples, devotees living in their homes. I just came from a wonderful model of people living in a kind of neighborhood, and in Stuyvesant Falls, New York. So there's so many different ways devotees are living now. You can see which way you fit in. Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to, I don't plan to take future disciples. So he can be initiated by another disciple who's he's attracted to. One writer I like, he was being asked about another writer who he liked, and he said, "Oh, he writes from the right straight from the blood." So, not just so that other scholars will appreciate him, or that he'll sell books. Or, but just in the heart and soul, his truth. So we're supposed to have lunch at 1, and then get back at 4. for looking at some art. And in the meantime, I have chosen a small number of pieces of art to show. Krishna Kirtan here? Anyway, I chose about 12 paintings. I chose 12? And so that's not so many. But before that, I have about 5 wooden ones, which I'm going to give out, show and give out as gifts. And then I'm going to show some of Krishna Kirtan's paintings. And then I've been asking, is Haryashva here? Yeah. Where are you? Yeah. How many did you finally get? 2. Anybody else bring anything?
Guru Seva.
What?
Guru Seva.
No one else? No. Okay, so during the show, those paintings will be shown too. So, but after lunch, there's quite a bit of time. I have a big roll of paintings that I'm not going to show during the show, but we can put them out on the floor somewhere in rolls, and if anyone wants to look through them.
Maybe up in that side room.
The side room. People can just look through them. They're extras. I didn't want to make the art show too long. Okay, thank you for giving me your time, and I look forward to all these books coming out in quantity.